This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Has football become too long and too confusing? And will the new wild card make it even more complicated? So this is Paul, who rang our breakfast program this morning.
Getting a bit confused here because we have the AFL now that has all sorts of complexities to it. Opening round, you know, the draft that nobody understands, the tribunal system that nobody understands. When you play finals, the highest ranked team's meant to get a home ground, but until the AFL says no. And now we have a wildcard system that just adds to that complexity. And if you can't make it after 23 or 24 rounds, I don't even know how many rounds we have in the system now because we have an opening round. I'm sort of expecting next year to have a closing round as well. I'm sort of at my wit's end, and I'm not sure if it's me or if it's other people that think the AFL is sort of going down this rabbit hole.
So are you at your wit's end as well, or is it just Paul? Are you struggling to keep up? Is it simply about keeping footy in the news and the headlines for longer, or is it about better outcomes for the fans and for the clubs? And also coming up a little later this hour,
I'm not going to lie to the good folks of Mildura. We ain't given up our vault sculpture here in Melbourne to your great city.
So do you care if the vault, which is also known as the Yellow Peril, do you care if it goes to Mildura? Or is it a case of we don't want it until somebody else does?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So has the new AFL, the new wild card, has it made football even more confusing? So this is Josh Barnes, again, speaking with Brekkie this morning.
The whole time I've said I see zero downside with a wild card weekend. The issue I have had is that they have branded it wrong. I don't think they should be calling it wild card weekend. If they just called it top 10 and top 6, we would understand it a lot better. It would be a lot clearer and we wouldn't think it's an American thing, which I think a lot of people bristle at. So entering next season, teams are going to be playing to finish in the top six. That's what the new target is. You still have your top four and your top six. Your top six are guaranteed into the final series in September. And then obviously you've got your top 10 where you're playing on that early weekend. It's an extra weekend of football. I think that's great. I think there was a gap there in the schedule. I think this solves a few problems and makes more exciting footy. I can't see any issue with this.
Corbin Middlemass, ABC Sport. Is footy now too long, too confusing? I listened to Paul on breakfast rattle off everything from the draft to when the footy begins, where it ends, how it's structured. And I had to say, I was nodding along.
I don't like things now as much as the way they used to be. I think there's a fair bit of that, obviously, that goes into it. Oh, I think the season is too long. I agree with that. I do follow the NFL, the American football, and I think they've got a perfect model where you play about 17, 18 games and then they head into a final system which does have a wild card as part of it, which obviously the AFL have officially announced today after Mitch Cleary's report last night. So that will be happening, which means now we do have a top 10, as Josh said. So essentially, if you're still playing footy when everybody else has stopped playing footy, you're in the postseason. You're in the finals. You're in the extra period. So you can call it a wild card. You can call it an additional round, whatever it is. It is now a top 10 as opposed to a top 8 system.
And is that too Americanized? So, is that what people are sort of unsure about?
So what I like about it, and you heard Andrew Dillon say there during the news, that I like that it's more games of consequence. So my issue with the competition at the moment is we have too many meaningless games late in the year. So if everyone plays 23 games, you're probably playing about another 6 games, I think, that essentially we don't need at the end of the season. There's so many dead rubbers. And so by the time it gets to September, I'm hanging out for it, mainly because they're games that have something on them. So I look at it very much as a sense that this is 2 more games that have a bit of jeopardy, that there's sudden death, they're blockbuster games. Oh, no, I'm going to be watching. I'm sure plenty of other football fans will be watching. First week of the finals, rather than having that bye week where there's nothing on, why not
get rid of it?
7th versus 10th, 8th versus 9th, you got 2 more games that are knockout finals, I think, that are a chance to try and capture people's imagination. And I know what people are saying, oh, you know, rewards mediocrity and everything else. I just think if you're good enough to win from 7th or from 8th or from 9th or from 10th.
That's pretty exciting footy.
Good luck to you that if you can run the table the whole way through. I think it's extremely unlikely we're going to get too many winners or even grand finalists from the lower portion of the 8.
This, oh my God, yes, in the news yesterday, and I thought, I'm done. Enough of these random changes, rule changes, trying to stay relevant. I might be back when they get rid of opening round. A lot of people are saying it's actually the opening round that annoys me more so than the wild card.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of opening round. I don't mind the idea of giving the northern states their weekend in the sun, so to speak. I actually think the best time for it would be in, say, the July school holidays. Like, imagine if you put it on there. There'd be a lot of people in Melbourne, I'm sure, that'd be keen to go and get some sun and perhaps head up north. So you could have, say, a split round on that weekend, and you make sure that the Suns, the Lions, the Swans and the Giants get home games and get a weekend to themselves. I think that would be better suited perhaps in another time of year. Whereas opening round, I can understand, footy's back. We've been waiting for it for 5 months or whatever it is. You need every team playing, I think, on that first weekend of the season. And now we've got this situation where I think 10 of the 18 teams are going to start their season next year in opening round, and then the other 8 will have to wait another week.
Kylie says, brilliant idea. I'll actually go and see more games. How much of it depends? Because like Paul, the caller who sparked this conversation, I do get confused now around, you know, who gets what games, who gets the key games, who gets the dodgy games, like, you know, the 4:40 on a Sunday, and how that impacts the final results and top 4, top 6, top 10. How much of that plays into it? And so maybe if it is the so-called wild round, it helps those that have got the dodgy scheduling throughout the year.
Yeah. So it drives pure footy people like Mick Mouldhouse, who I'm lucky enough to work with every Saturday. It drives him insane how commercialised it all is, because it very much is that they put the big teams in the big slots, the teams that you want to see, for example, that are playing exciting footy, and then really the rest of the competition or the teams that are struggling are out on the boondocks, for example. And if you are a side like North Melbourne, for example, who have struggled on field and then also don't have the biggest commercial support, that doesn't help that all of a sudden you're playing in these less desirable time slots. But otherwise, we would be having the other debate. We'd be sitting here during the season saying, how come we're watching these teams that are no good? Put the good sides in the big slots when everyone's huddled around the TV or whatever for the shared viewing experience, which is, and it shows us in terms of eyeballs, Thursday night, Friday night.
Well, as a St Kilda supporter, the fact that we've got up against Collingwood, you know, opening round Friday night, MCG, I couldn't tell you as a St Kilda supporter the last time that happened.
Yeah, so the Saints have asked for that. So they wanted a feature time slot and opportunity to do it. And it's no surprise again here. So the Saints are looking for a dance partner to put on a big event, and they look straight to the Magpies. So as much as we all roll our eyes and say, oh, Collingwood get so many advantages, it's actually the smaller teams in the competition that lean on the Magpies and the big clubs in the competition, Carlton, Essendon, for example, and their fan base to try and put on a mega event. Because if St Kilda said, hey, we want this prime time slot, schedule us against whoever you like, and they all of a sudden play North Melbourne or Fremantle or the Gold Coast, it's nowhere near a big as event. So that they actually need the pulling power of the big club, and that's where Collingwood are not only great for the competition themselves and the huge might and power that they are, they're great for all the other clubs in the competition in what they're able to do.
Is it about money for the AFL? Like, fundamentally, the longer we're talking about them, the longer footy runs, the more they make.
Well, I think the problem, I mean, that their idea is clearly they want to keep the AFL in the news as long as possible. I mean, they want to be the dominant sport in the country. And I don't think it's really the AFL's responsibility to make sure that basketball or netball or any of these other sports get a look in. The way they would look at it, they would think, well, we provide an option for young boys and girls to be able to play our game. And so as a result, we want to make Australian rules football as popular as possible. The other thing that the AFL doesn't have, as much as it probably frustrates some pure footy people that footy's a winter sport and that's when it's meant to be played, and then let us focus on the cricket and whatever else during the summer months, they don't have a viewership problem. I mean, the Herald Sun's selling 20 pages a day of footy content in the off season, and the reason for that is because people are clicking on the articles, they're reading it. It's what people are chatting about online, and driving social media numbers and everything else. So that they don't have a viewership issue. The AFL, people are still consuming this, whether it's trade conversation or fixture chat in the off season in a huge number. Otherwise, it wouldn't be doing the business it is.
It's really divided. Texts are saying, "Yep, love it." Absolutely, and others just saying, no, absolutely not. It's too long, too confusing now. Where do you think it will fall, Corbs? Somewhere in the middle?
I think January, December, I think the Ashes will take over and completely dominate the mainstream sort of media landscape. So I think the AFL will have a quieter window then, coming up after perhaps the national draft. So, yes, they'll hang on to as many headlines as they can through to the end of November, the AFLW grand final obviously to take place during that time. But then basically once the Ashes is done and the Big Bash is finished in and the tennis is over at the end of January, whew, into overdrive again, foot on the gas, and it'll all be footy from February onwards. So really it feels like it dominates 10 months of the year.
It really does.
Yeah.
Finally, wild card, is it the right title? Was Josh right? Does it need a rebrand? Does it feel too American?
I don't have an issue with it. I feel like when it comes to the Americanization of our society, I mean, people...
Too late?
Yeah. I mean, people...
That ship has sailed.
Watch American TV shows, consume American music. I feel like it almost breaks down in age gap, that people sort of over the age of 45 have a lot of British influences, and people are under the age of 45, and I'm one of those, we're influenced by a lot of American stuff. And I mean, people go to the polls nowadays and vote with a very Americanized philosophy and everything else. So I feel like if you're waiting or you're worried about that infiltrating Australian life, that's long gone.
Those days are gone. Those old days are trying to keep everything the same. Corbin, always good to pick your brain. Thank you.
Anytime.
Corbin Middlemass, a part of ABC Sport. Coming up in just a moment, if you've looked back through some of your parents' or your grandparents' photographs, in particular on that huge day where 200,000 people lined the streets of Melbourne, which did mark the end of World War II, if you're holding on to that photograph, then there are some people who may want it. That's next.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So this year marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and it was estimated that about 200,000 people lined the streets of Melbourne back on the 15th of August in 1945. People abandoned their workstations and they celebrated in the streets. Now, you know a certain image. It's an iconic photograph, and it was taken on VP Day. So this was Victory in the Pacific Day. And it was, I think it was in Collins Street in a doorway, possibly the Kodak factory. Now, this photo became famous for a couple of women. And there was one woman in the centre who was wearing a hand-knitted sweater that said VP Day. Now, that jumper, for example, is a part of the Australian War Memorial collection. However, RSL Victoria is hoping to get to know and to connect with some of the descendants of not just that woman in the centre of the picture, but the two women either side of her. So maybe you have a particular photograph of a family member, of an aunt, an uncle, a grandfather, a dad, a mum who was there or maybe overseas, but somehow marking the end of World War II. David Curtin is the RSL's memorabilia officer, and Kate Spinks-Collers is the curator of exhibitions and collections from the Shrine of Remembrance. A warm welcome to the two of you. Of course, tomorrow marks Remembrance Day. But when we think about this particular photograph and these three now iconic women who are going to be memorialised in a badge that you're putting out, but when we think about that particular image and what it represents, why is it so important? I might put that to you first, David.
As you said, there's three women on the front of it. In 1995, the Herald Sun put out a call to people to see if they could identify the three people on that photo. And fortunately, William Drew identified his wife, who was in the centre there wearing the jumper. And her name is Lois Ann Martin. The other two, we've also identified them, but we can't find any relatives to contact. So if anyone's out there, I can give you the names of the other two.
Yes, please.
So we have Betty Williams, and her married name was Gibson, and Carmel O'Connor. So if anyone knows of those people or relatives of them, we'd love to hear from you.
Isn't it incredible when we look at the role that photographs play and how they document history? And especially now in a time where we're taking more photos, but we're not doing anything with them. They're just sitting on our phones and clogging up our memory on our phones, and we're not printing them out. We're not archiving them. We're not putting them in shoeboxes and hiding them away. Why is this image just so important, and why are you trying to reconnect with family members?
Yeah, it's a really beautiful photo, isn't it? And I think what is lovely about it is that it's really encapsulating a collective memory, and it's representative of a very important and specific moment in time. And, you know, their beautiful sort of, you know, joyous faces kind of encapsulates the feeling of everybody in Melbourne mm-hmm. and around the world at the time, you know, in terms of the end of the Second World War. So, yeah, I guess those images really represent that collective memory that we feel. And the photographs are just a window into a time that we can't really access in many other ways.
And the fact that they're everyday women, I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people, not just in the streets of Melbourne, but all around the world, marked that moment in some way. So you're also calling for people maybe that have photographs of people who were serving overseas or were maybe somewhere else around the country that marked that with a photograph. But the idea that it doesn't have to be somebody famous or a scene that's famous, that it could just be a family member and a very ordinary photograph. That's how history is told.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when we look through a lot of the photographs in the Shrines collection, you know, a lot of them are, you know, sort of everyday kind of photos of people in service, and they, you know, they're just capturing that moment. They're capturing what service was like. They're capturing the conditions that they were working under, the kinds of roles that they had, mm-hmm. You know, the uniforms and fashions of the day. Yeah, they're really pretty fascinating for lots of different reasons. And they don't have to be, like you say, you know, some sort of...
Yeah, official person.
No.
I mean, one of the problems we find, however, is that a lot of the photos aren't inscribed. We don't know who the people are, where they was taken. And, you know, I encourage everyone who has photos to actually write on them or make a notation somewhere.
Document them in some way,
Who the people are, where it was taken, and when it was taken.
And so the jumper as well, that very iconic jumper that Lois was wearing in the photograph that's been donated now to the, I think it's the War Memorial. I mean, as the memorabilia officer, you just mentioned multiple things that people might have. What are some of the other key items that may be in family shoeboxes, that may be in the back of cupboards that people don't know about, that could be of significance?
Yeah, look, we find we get donated items such as military badges, photographs, framed documents, equipment, and that type of thing. And also it can go to the extreme that recently we had a collection from Currumburra, and the family actually approached the Currumburra RSL and you know, asked them if they wanted a donation for the of the collection. And Tony Moon, the vice president there, said, sure, bring it in. After three or four ute loads of trunks, he said, oh, look, that's too much for a small RSL. We can't handle that. So they contacted RSL Victoria, Anzac House, and, you know, hoped that we could do something with it. And I went down to Currumburra, went through the collection, and I was astounded.
What was in there?
We couldn't take it on either.
What was in there? I mean, is that many trunk loads?
Well, the items belong to a chap named Lieutenant Colonel Patterson, and he served in the Victorian Scottish Regiment prior to First World War, and then he was a CO of the 39th Battalion during the First World War and wrote the unit history. And he collected all these items, such as uniforms, documents, battle plans, books, his medals. He had two gallantry medals. And when I, you know, as I said, I assessed the collection and Anzac House couldn't have it. So we then spoke to the family and said, well, you're prepared to go to the Australian War Memorial. And they agreed to that. We had representatives come down and have a look at the collection. They were very interested in it. However, they took the family aside and said, well, you know, what sort of outcome do you want with this collection? And he did advise them that it wouldn't be displayed straight away. It may not be displayed for some years. But they were happy with that, and the collection's just gone to the Australian War Memorial over the last couple of months. So that's from one extreme to the other, from a little badge to a large collection like that. It's amazing.
And most RSLs, I'm thinking of the small town where I grew up in Trafalgar, and the local RSL, it's, well, once would be run by former members, and as they age and pass on, then you're looking at relatives of sons and of daughters and of other people connected to keep them running. So even keeping local RSLs up and running is a mission within itself, isn't it?
It's very difficult nowadays, for sure, yes. And and also storing donations. We don't have the room, or to preserve items such as uniforms, you just don't have the capacity to do that.
If people are somehow connected to the three women in this photograph, how should they best contact you? So we know that Louise Ann Drew was the woman in the middle. Can we just give the names of the other two, just in case people are listening or they know of someone?
So there's Betty Williams and her married name's Gibson.
So Betty Gibson or Betty Williams, yeah.
Yeah, and the other one is Carmel O'Connor.
Carmel O'Connor.
So if there's anyone out there who thinks they're related to them, we'd love to hear from them.
Absolutely. The idea of handing over photographs, these are treasured items, and people would be concerned about that. But you're not giving them up as such, are you?
Well, no. I mean, in a way, you're giving them to everybody. So, you know, when they can go on display or maybe be digitised and be accessible online, they become available to all Victorians and all Australians through collections like the Shrine Collection or some of the RSLs or the Australian War Memorial Collection. So, you know, you're really gifting that history or that object or that photograph a new life and a new audience who can enjoy and, you know, learn about that history, I think.
Do you think people are sitting on photographs or sitting on pieces where they don't realise the significance? So the photograph of these three women that we're talking about, it's iconic. It's in Collins Street. There was hundreds of thousands of people. But on that day, people may have just celebrated in their backyard, in their street, in their homes with family members. Are they as important?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because as I was saying, that it's all part of the collective memory about, you know, a very important moment in our history, and you know, capturing that sort of that social history and that cultural history through photography or through, you know, material culture. It doesn't have to be a famous person. It doesn't have to be their photo or their object. It's still fascinating to understand how everyday people responded and reacted. And, you know, the end of the Second World War, all wars that Australians have been involved in impact everybody, the whole community. So, you know, learning about how that has impacted across the board is also important.
You could be sitting on the next iconic image, but that image is being put onto a badge, isn't it?
That's right, yes, yes. Now, it's interesting to know where people were at the end of the Second World War. I mean, I know my father was in Darwin when peace was declared. My mother-in-law, Gunner Norma Ward, she was in Brisbane. She'd been trained as an anti-aircraft gunner. She shipped to Brisbane on her way to New Guinea when peace was declared.
Do you have is there photographs that document that time?
Unfortunately, we don't have a photo, wow. But she was very annoyed that she couldn't get to New Guinea.
Yeah. So what do you want people to look at these badges, buy the badges, and the money then goes back into local RSLs?
Yeah, all the funds raised from these badges goes back to veteran welfare. And now look, in 2024, the RSL received 98% more requests for support from veterans.
Wow.
That's an amazing figure. And veterans face a rate of homelessness three times greater and at a risk of suicide 30% higher than the broader population. So veterans are also more likely to face unemployment, been subject to financial strain, experience a greater number of traumatic life events. So I encourage people to go out there and buy a badge, whether it's a dollar badge or $20 or $50, just to go towards veterans' welfare.
And if people are now inspired to go and look through some of the photographs or to maybe reconnect with other family members, we've always got that one person in our family, you know, that does the family tree, that collects and holds on to everything. How should they best contact you if they think that they come across something that might be significant? Is it just through RSL Victoria?
Well, for the Shrine, we encourage people to contact us and by filling out an online form on our website, www.shrine.org.au, and they can send us in all the information and some images of the objects or photographs that they would like to donate to the Shrine. And, you know, if people want to ask questions, there's also an email address that they can contact us on, which is donationsinquiries@shrine.org.au.
And can they give you a buzz, especially too, if we're talking about some of our older audience members who maybe can't jump online or don't have computer access? Can they? Is there a number or something?
What we find is a lot of people go to their RSL sub branches, and ask if they can donate items, and so we assess them to see if they're relevant for the collection. Probably more so than going to Anzac House, mm. because they're close by, being elderly, they've got their own local RSL they can go to.
Yeah, and someone can point them in the right direction. That's absolutely correct. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and of course we'll be thinking of you all tomorrow on Remembrance Day, which will be there'll be big, I guess, moments in time, not just here in Melbourne, but in all of those smaller community towns all across Victoria tomorrow. Thank you so much, David Curtin, who's the RSL's Memorabilia Officer, and Kate Spinks-Cole is the Curator of Exhibitions and Collections from the Shrine of Remembrance.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Coming up in the next 10, 15 minutes or so, do you care if Mildura takes the vault? So the vault, also known as the Yellow Peril, they want it. They're starting a campaign saying bring the vault home. And now all of a sudden, a few of us, including our own Lord Mayor, say no way we are keeping it. So is it a case of we don't want it until somebody else does? If you live in Mildura, are you a fan? Are you someone that is a big believer that it should come home, the vault should come home? So that's coming up in about 15 minutes. So, but where I'm living at the moment, there's a little pond, right, a little waterway just at the end of the street. And I have to tell you, this is a busy, noisy little place. And at first, I didn't recognise the sound. Now, the sound that I'm talking about can actually get quite loud. And when I walked up closer, I realised it was frogs, and lots of them. And there is this thriving little home, this habitat to frogs right at the end of the street. And I had no idea. So I think that maybe I need to put myself into the app as a part of Frog ID Week. Dr. Jody Rawley is a conservation biologist and the lead scientist behind Frog ID at the Australian Museum. Jody, you would love this little pond where I am. They are noisy little critters and they don't shut up 24/7.
That is fantastic. With a bit of rain recently, the frogs have been kind of going off. This is the perfect time of year to listen to all of the frogs, particularly along eastern Australia. Yeah.
I've never heard, you know, when you hear a frog, for whatever reason, I get so excited because it's quite a rare sound. But then to hear them en masse, and I said to my daughter, I wonder what they're saying. They seem so happy and there seems to be so many of them. Is it the rain that is making them so joyous at the moment?
Yeah, it's the rain and a bit of, well, sort of mostly warm weather, although it hasn't quite got to the sort of summer that's been in the average day. But yeah, the frogs, a lot of the frogs, this is the time where they're going to breed. And what are they saying? Well, it's actually males that are singing their little hearts out to attract female frogs to breed. So they're essentially just yelling out what species they are and hoping that they sound good enough that the female frogs will sort of emerge, hop across people's backyards and paddocks and things and come to that bit of water and breed.
Look at me, look at me, look at me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yep.
So the Frog ID Week, this is now in its eighth year. So look, I'm a little bit embarrassed, but I was listening to it going, I don't even know what they would look like or what sort of frogs are here. Does the average Victorian or Australian even know what potential frogs are in their local area?
Well, look, I think it's getting better. I think Frog ID has really helped that. So one of the, I think, great things about Frog ID is we made it as easy as possible. So if you just download the Frog ID app, which is free for your phone, go down to that pond, record the calls for 20 seconds, and then submit that to us. You don't need to know what they are. We will identify all of those frog calls, let you know what species they are, and then you'll learn your local frogs. So there's been a whole lot of people over these 8 years. We've had over 100,000 people across Australia download the app, record frogs. Some knew what the frogs were before, but most probably didn't. And I think this is a great way to learn, also teach your kids what kind of frogs are around you, and also you sort of start to be a bit more cued into the weather and the conditions, and you know, you're like, oh, it's spring. Yeah, I just, you know, over winter, my striped marsh frogs in my backyard in Sydney, they shut up, and it just the first warm night, all of a sudden, bok, bok, and I'm like, oh, it's spring. The frogs are on it.
It's just something just so charming about the sound. Why is it important to document frogs?
Well, for two reasons. One is frogs are hugely important parts of healthy ecosystems, and they're in trouble. So one in five of all of Australian frogs are threatened with extinction. We've already lost probably about 8 species of frog. You know, we haven't seen them in decades. And so they really need our help. Wow. And one of the easy things we can do is help figure out where they are, which ones need our help, and which ones are doing fine, what kind of breeding habitat they have. And so it's super easy just to record them. But the other thing is that frogs, because they are so sensitive to environmental conditions, if we just monitor our local frogs, we're actually monitoring the health of our environment too.
So why have we lost so many, Jodie? I mean, that's quite confronting, actually.
They are kind of the canaries in the coal mine. You know, that's kind of the thing that's a really early sort of warning of something not going well. So we definitely should be paying attention. Habitat loss and modification is the biggest thing. You know, we might do simple things, make a pond a bit more permanent, clear the vegetation, things like that. And the frogs, a lot of frogs, most frog species, can't really persist with that kind of change. You know, some are in the middle of cities, but they're the extra super tough ones. And the other thing is disease. So somewhere probably around the 70s, Australia accidentally introduced a type of fungal disease that affects our frogs, the amphibian chytrid fungus, and that wiped out a lot of frogs. It's still having huge impacts. And that one's tricky because it's even within protected areas, you know, pristine habitats, this fungus is still hitting our frogs hard.
This Libby, who's driving to Geelong, she says, I love frog ID. I've been recording since 2017. I've learnt so much about my local frogs and also frogs in place when I travel. I absolutely love it. If you have a frog question, 1300 222 774. Rowan's in Tura. Hi, Rowan.
Good to be.
Morning.
Yeah, I've got a story about a frog named turning into a village.
Yes, cool. What's your story? Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm an ex-Werribee boy, and there used to be a town in the sewage farm at the Borderworks Farm, used to be what they call it, a Western treatment plant now, but it was called Cockerock. And that's the sound of the growling grass frog, because it used to be all swampland once upon a time, so that's why they built the sewage farm, and Cockerock is growling grass frog call, so yeah.
And do you love spotting frogs, Rowan?
Oh, I'm always got my ears open. Yeah. Oh, look, I know a bit about frogs now, their calls and, you know, yeah, I've kind of slept in caravan parks and camping grounds being surrounded by frogs and being, you know, just an orchestra.
It's, and it's interesting, Rowan, when you talk about, you know, former swamps and the association, Jodie, that we have with swamps, that, you know, while they're just places of insignificance, that they're swamps, right? We don't even have a good historical view, or we have a stereotypical view on what a swamp is. But these are wetlands for frogs and places to breed.
Yeah, frogs definitely need these kind of wild spaces, sometimes messy spaces. And I think, you know, they also provide a lot of food for the other things that maybe often we appreciate more, like water birds and things like that. But, you know, frogs are a huge part of Australian culture. They're, you know, responsible. Their calls are responsible for towns being named. We also have some really, like, a lot of Australian frogs are named after their call. So we've got the growling grass frog, so it does a little sort of noise. And then obviously there's the pobble bonk as well, which throughout Victoria is pretty famous. And that's a pretty amazing sort of, it's sort of a bonk, bonk. But when there's a lot of them, it kind of does sound like bobble bonk, bobble bonk, bobble bonk.
That's just the most joyous sound, especially en masse. At the moment, I'm transfixed by it. There's a lovely text here from Dylan, and it says, I lifted a rock in my garden last week and there were 3 spotted marsh frogs under it. I immediately added it to the app. So this is what we want people to do, so that we can document where frogs are all around Australia. But Jodie, when you mentioned that 8 species have been lost, I mean, how many species do we have roughly?
Well, we actually don't know. More than 250 species, but in the last sort of, since Frog ID has been going, 8 years, we've actually used the Frog ID recordings in part, as well as genetics and the appearance of the frogs, to describe 13 new species to science. So it's crazy that we don't yet know how many frog species we have in Australia. And some of these, you know, have been from the East Coast, places that we think might, you know, that are pretty well known. But in fact, we don't yet know how many frog species we have in Australia. So it's exciting times for everyone out there with the Frog ID app, because people are really making huge advances. We're, you know, discovering new species with the help of Frog ID. We're remapping the where we thought our frogs were. You know, someone records a frog on their deck and all of a sudden we're like, oh, it's 100 kilometres more east than we thought
went
to. You know, so there is a lot of scope to make significant discoveries, particularly if you're within the 60% of Australia that is yet to have a Frog ID recording, and that includes parts of Victoria.
And imagine if that was you, in terms of being a citizen scientist, and you were the one that recorded it and uploaded the sound or the image, and yet for people like yourself, Jody, thought that maybe frogs hadn't been spotted there, you know, for decades, and you're the one that finds it when you lift up a pebble in your backyard.
Yeah, it really can happen. I remember one guy up in the Northern Territory found, he recorded the call of a striped rocket frog. And that literally was 100 kilometres from where we thought it went. And he said, I was just a couple of metres from my beer fridge on my deck, you know. So pretty minimal investment, but maximum scientific outcomes. And I think that, yeah, so that's great. So Frog ID Week is all about trying to like fill those gaps. And certainly we have a couple of grid cells in Victoria around Sunset Wilderness Zone, Murray Sunset National Park, Mount Carroll Wilderness Zone, those areas up in the northwest where we actually have no Frog ID recordings at all. So,
it could be yours.
To fill those gaps in.
And to check your beer fridge, man. Like, it doesn't have to be... It doesn't have to be under a rock. It can be in the garage and can be near the beer fridge. This says, I remember participating in the frog census about 20 years ago. We would take a CD player with a CD of different frog calls and we'd play it in spots where they'd been located before. It was so much fun. If people want to, you know, grab a CD player or check their beer fridge and see whether or not there are frogs there, what's the best way of them participating in Frog ID Week, Jody?
Well, thankfully, our technology's improved since the old CD player. So now you just search for Frog ID wherever you download your apps for your phone. So it's a free app. And then head out there tonight and press record. Record 20 seconds of your local frogs croaking and submit that to us. So you don't need to know what it is. You don't need to enter anything else in. The location and date and everything's automatic. We'll listen to those recordings, ID the frogs, and we're hoping we will crack 1.4 million frog records across Australia and fill in some of those gaps too.
So at this little pond where it sounds like there's hundreds of frogs, if I record them en masse, can you pick out who's who and what's what?
We can. So we've actually got up to 13 species calling at once in some of our recordings. Usually takes a few of our team to listen to them. Look, we are working on machine learning, so we hope that AI can help us. But honestly, at the moment, humans are still better at telling apart a frog chorus.
This is what we want to hear. All right, well, I'm going to get out my phone as opposed to my CD and I'm going to record these frogs at the end of my street for you, Jody.
Thank you so much.
That's part of Frog ID Week. You can upload that onto your phone. You can go out and you can record and be a part of Frog ID Week. Dr. Jody Rawley, conservation biologist, lead scientist behind Frog ID. Coming up next, the Vault, or Vault, you might know it as Yellow Peril. We've complained about it for years. We've been embarrassed about it for years. We move it around from place to place. We don't really care about it so much. That is until Mildura says, we'll take it, please. And now all of a sudden we want it. So like Shane, it says, well, I hope Vault goes to Mildura where it can be appreciated. People in Melbourne have been complaining about it for the last 40 years. I drive past it every day. It looks like it needs a bit of TLC. Do you care if it goes to Mildura?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Bubble bonk, bubble bonk, bubble bonk.
So if you think that maybe you've heard a frog or seen a frog in your area, you can be a part of Frog ID Week. You can just need to pop that onto your phone, the app, the Frog ID app, onto your phone or onto some kind of device, and you can go out and be a part of it. Well, this is a classic kind of we don't like it until somebody else wants it. And of course, I'm talking about Vault. We know it as the Yellow Peril. Now, Mildura has said, we want to bring it home. We'll explain why they claim they own it in just a minute. But in case you missed this morning, if you're in our regional area, our Lord Mayor, Nick Rees, was speaking to ABC Mildura Swan's breakfast program, Ben Murphy, around the fact that now all of a sudden Nick Rees is saying that
our vault isn't going anywhere.
Well, essentially at the moment, I guess it is dumped on a dirt expanse at the front of Acca. Is that part of its storytelling or just where it kind of ended up?
Well, go easy with the word dumped there, Ben. that expanse you speak of is the forecourt to Acca, the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art, and it's a gateway to the South Bank Arts Precinct in Melbourne, which is the preeminent arts precinct in all of Australia. And I guess the bigger point about the vault sculpture is while it was very controversial in its early days, I think Melburnians have very much come around regarding it.
Really? 1-300-222-774. I drive past it every day. And I think I agree with Ben Murphy, who we're going to chat with in just a moment. I feel like it has been dumped. And I also question the label that Lord Mayor Nick Rees gave that particular space as being the gateway to our arts precinct. I'm not really sure about that. So do you care if Vault goes to Mildura? They claim it's rightfully theirs and it's going home. We'll find out why that is in just a tick. But Fiona, what do you think?
Yes, I think it should definitely stay. It's been where it is now for years and it's bright and optimistic and it's a talking point. No, leave it. We love it now.
I drive past it. Do you think? I drive past it every day, Fiona.
I walk past it every day and I love it. And so do all my friends.
I love it as well, but I feel like it is neglected and I feel like there's little touch-ups on it that look a bit dodgy. I feel like we haven't cared about it until Mildura says, we'll take it, please.
Well, it doesn't matter. The point is keep it because it's part of our history, part of our heritage, and it's bright. I mean, there's so little colour in Melbourne in terms of buildings and structures. Everything's grey and beige and grey. No, leave it. We love it.
Good on you, Fiona. Thank you. 1-300-222-774. This text. Morning, Rish. Never mind the vault or whatever it's called. Mildura wants a passenger train service and they've wanted that since 1993 and we're still waiting. That's from Paul. Ben Murphy, ABC Mildura Swans breakfast program. Which debate do we start? The give us back our train line, Ben, or the we'll take your vault? Thank you very much.
I think the bigger question is how is that the gateway to the arts precinct? It is a pile of dirt.
Yeah, I took issue with that being the gateway to the arts precinct because it doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, it takes you to the theatre, it takes you to Malthouse, but other than that, I think it takes you to a really large chemist. There's not too much else that's there. How are locals, what's Talkback saying at the moment around whether or not it rightfully belongs in Mildura?
Well, there's been a bit of a conflict because Council Manager of Strategy and Growth, Phil Stone, said he wants it back in Mildura. But a lot of people have commented online and in Talkback that it never actually came to Mildura, so it can't be coming back at all. We've just got another piece of artwork there by the same artist called Beethoven, and Mildura's decided that they'd like Vault there as well. I mean, it is big and beautiful, and currently in its Melbourne location, it's covered in graffiti, so we'd probably take better care of it.
Right, so the artist himself, so Ron Swan, he doesn't have a connection to Mildura. It's just that you guys have another piece, which is kind of like a blue, smaller version.
Yeah,
really,
it's
Vault,
a green sort of very small sort of, petite version of it.
Well, Henry's in Kyneton. Hi, Harry. Sorry, apologies.
Yeah, right. G'day, Rish. Just had a brainwave.
Yeah.
I wonder whether the architects of the cheese stick on CityLink actually chose to paint it the same colour.
Because it's connected.
Yeah, they might have been referencing the famous vault.
Would you care, Harry, if the vault went to Mildura?
I think it should still be in Melbourne. I mean, surely it's ours, but for better or worse, it represents an interesting story for Melbourne, I think, about how the arts evolved.
What I am interested in as well, Ben Murphy, and I'll be curious to know whether or not locals are feeling this. There's a really big push by Mildura at the moment, of which I think is really exciting and I'm very happy about, because anything that brings money, brings focus to regional parts of our state, I think is a win-win for everyone. But between, you know, Lenny Kravitz and a call for it to be given, you know, a tropical label, like that Mildura is our far north Queensland, then on top of it, you know, there's a big push to create this cultural hub, including the vault. Is that
something that everybody wants? Is that an energy that is real across Mildura at the moment, or is it all marketing?
I would say 100%. Like, Mildura is such a beautiful place. I'm from Melbourne originally, but based out of Mildura now, and the weather is absolutely amazing. I've come back just to check out this piece of art, and I can't wait to head back to Mildura. We've got so many beautiful sculptures and artists and great artists like Lenny Kravitz coming, and like a lot smaller venues in the city. You can get up closer. It's a phenomenal place to be.
I love holidaying in Mildura because it's hot. You can drive there, although it is a 6-hour drive, right? So you need snacks, you need lots of stopping.
It is quite far.
Yeah. So the argument of just give us back our train, has that got weight to it?
Look, I think that's probably at the heart of most people in Mildura. Like, we really, really want to train. That's been something that's back and forth. We talk about a lot on the breakfast program up there, but it doesn't look like we're getting any closer to getting that dream, unfortunately.
Let's have a chat to Andrea in Altona. Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Where should it live?
It should live in Melbourne. I remember... I'm getting old now, giving away my age.
Aren't we all?
I remember it's been around for a long time. I love the controversy around it. I love that people love to hate it. And I think if Mildura want one, they can commission their own.
Is it not good for Mildura though, Andrea? What about if we loaned it for a long time?
Oh, I don't think we'd get it back. Rochelle, I just don't think it would come back.
Yeah.
That's okay. The only issue. It's not easy to transport, is it?
When was the last time you went to Mildura, Andrea?
Oh, it was a few years ago when my daughter was a bit younger, and I love Mildura. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a wonderful foodie place as well.
Yeah, it's got great food.
But they need their own artwork.
Oh, what do you think, Ben? Them Spartan words, hey?
Oh, I don't know. There was absolutely no one looking at the piece of artwork today, so I don't think Melbourne like it as much as they're pretending at the moment.
We were just with friends on the weekend, and we were talking about how and why Mildura ended up with Lenny Kravitz, and how Lenny Kravitz is playing your big sports stadium there and isn't playing a big stadium in Melbourne. But when we talk about the arts and the city versus regional areas, we know Bendigo Art Gallery, which is under construction at the moment, under renovation. However, they are so well known for their exhibitions. They quite often in bids beat the National Gallery of Victoria to host some of the largest exhibitions that Australia will house. Do you think this is just a city versus country debate?
Yeah, maybe, but I think like anything, you don't get what you don't ask for, and it's a great way to let people know that we're still here and there's a whole lot of great stuff that maybe people aren't aware that's happening in Mildura. So regardless of what happens out of it, it's got the conversation going.
It certainly has. Marion's in McKinnon. Hi, Marion.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What are your thoughts?
Just a month ago, I did a trip with a company called Slow Rail Journeys. And it had three engines, three old engines and four carriages. But we went up to Mildura. We stopped at Creswick on the way to stay. And it's a whole, I took up the whole train, of course. And we saw, out of Mildura, we saw the walls of China, which is all that architectural, or what do you call it? Original landscaping area. And we also went to Mungo National Park, which has got a lot of... Aboriginal history there. We had an Aboriginal fellow, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name, he came along and talked to us about the area. It's a marvellous place. You sort of, you know, what's up there? But there's plenty of things to see. And actually the Walls of China, that's on a stamp from the 1990s. Russell Drysdale did a painting and then he got his painting on a stamp for that time. And
I agree, Marion. There's so much to do there. And
yes,
it's. I love the idea that there is the big push that's coming, Ben, you know, from the council, from locals. You've got local business operators as well. And what they've called the beginning of a wider tourism campaign, sort of portraying Mildura as the new arts and culture capital. How possible is that?
I think it's very possible. We've got the first Mildura Fringe happening at the moment. We've got a whole exhibition of borrowed artwork from the NGV at the moment. It's just a natural progression. Just we're getting more and more of the bigger stuff there. More people are coming. The tourism numbers are up. And it's just a beautiful place all year round. So you can come up and check it out anytime. And I mean, of all places in Australia, Lenny Kravitz is coming there. Not Bendigo, not anywhere else. He's coming to us.
Are you going? Because you got to interview him, didn't you?
I did get to interview him. Yeah, it was very exciting. So there may be even another interview to come.
Is he as cool as he appears?
He was so cool.
Was it a face-to-face?
It was via Zoom, and I was so nervous that I went and put aftershave on before the Zoom, thinking, oh, my gosh, I've got to be good for this. And then I realised, it's via Zoom. What an idiot.
Oh, I think I would faint if I got to interview Lenny Kravitz. Like, he's such an icon. He feels untouchable that if I was speaking to him in real time, it's like when I met Eugene Levy in the foyer here at work.
Wow.
I still haven't gotten over it. Like, I still go, was that real or did I dream that?
The thing about him is he's as charming as you'd expect. You've got that nerves at the start, but then he's so charming that it kind of disarms you, and he's just such a welcoming, lovely guy. It's kind of rare in a big celebrity like that.
Was he dressed in his leathers, chest showing the whole works?
He was. He was in the singlet. He was sitting in the Bahamas. He had beads around his neck. His knee was up by his chin with his arm lean over there. It was the most iconic rock pose you could imagine. It was exactly as you'd picture it.
Well, if you get to meet him again, Ben Murphy, can I just say that I might accidentally happen to be in Mildura and have to work out of Mildura ABC that day, and I may or may not have to come with you, okay?
Well, you're welcome anytime, Mildura. I'd love to have all of you from Melbourne. And come and see the vault when it gets here.
I love it. Thanks, Ben. Ben Murphy, ABC Mildura Swan Hill Breakfast presenter. Do you think that they should have it? You know, we like this text here that says, let them have it. We fight about it. We call it ugly. And then all of a sudden somebody wants it. And now we say, nope, you can't have it. My name's Rochelle. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, take care. And we'll speak soon.